We're going to turn to our next case of the morning. I want to make sure I pronounce the last name correctly, so Mr. Vorobyev, you can correct me, but it's United States v. Kirilyuk.
Good morning, Your Honor. It is correct. Gene Vorobyev on behalf of Mr. Kirilyuk, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. The court has identified three issues that we should focus on, and unless the court has a different preference, my plan was to start with the first issue identified in the order and focus on that. But I can begin anywhere where the court prefers.
Do you mind starting with the $500 per card argument?
Of course not, Your Honor. The $500 per card rule is invalid because, in this case, the commentary is not a reasonable interpretation of the guideline use of the term loss. It's at odds with the common meaning of that word.
So this is your argument in your reply brief based on the recent Sixth Circuit decision in Riccardi?
Well, I think the Kaiser theory of that argument is in the reply brief. That's correct, and it is based on Riccardi. I think we did sort of raise the Stinson issue in the opening brief as well, because we argued that the definition of loss that the commentary uses is inconsistent with the guidelines use of the term loss. We didn't really focus on the conflict between the commentary and the text itself. We focused more on the fact that as the circuit interpreted the term loss, that's in conflict with the commentary. So I will agree with that characterization. So I think we did sort of raise the Stinson issue, but not the Kaiser issue. I don't know if that distinction makes sense to the court, but.
So would the Kaiser issue be waived?
Well, I won't say that it should be deemed waived, because it's a new case, and I do agree that the government didn't get a chance to brief it, but we did raise it in the reply brief promptly after the case came out, and if the court is not inclined to treat the Kaiser issue as sort of a full-standing issue in its own right, it should give us at least both sides an opportunity to brief it.
But you think the Stinson argument was properly presented in the opening brief?
So I believe
if we were convinced by the concurrence in Riccardi, do you think that is not waived?
Right.
Okay. So go ahead. Sorry.
Right, and I would also add that I think whether you apply Stinson or Kaiser, you're dealing with the same essential problem, and you get to the same result, really, because what's at bottom here is that the commentary is not a reasonable interpretation of the guideline itself. So that means under Stinson, it wouldn't get deference, and it means that under Kaiser wouldn't get deference, as the Supreme Court has clarified.
Why do you think this issue is still open in the circuit? I mean, we have the Yellow decision. We have the decision, albeit unpublished, but it was Mr. Kirilyuk's co-defendant, Melkonyan, who had the same $500 multiplier applied to him. So what's your argument as to how this panel could achieve the result you're seeking?
Right. The response to the first question is that the Yellow didn't address this issue. What Yellow addressed was whether the commentary applies to credit cards, physical credit cards, not just numbers. So that's not the issue before the court. It's different. Here, the issue is a conflict between the commentary and the guideline. So I don't think there is a published case from the circuit that addresses that issue. Plus, should the court disagree with me on this, I think Kaiser constitutes intervening authority in light of Miller versus Gammy, and that would be the alternative way for the court to get to their argument. Now, I emphasize that I think Yellow doesn't address that issue, but if the court disagrees with me, then I think Kaiser, was a 2019 Supreme Court decision, constitutes intervening authority, which I think irreconcilably undercuts any analysis you can deduce from Yellow on this issue.
Counsel, if I agreed with you that Yellow wasn't precisely this issue, but it does say in its analysis, quote, this loss is a presumed loss, setting a floor beneath which neither actual nor intended loss may fall. So it does suggest that the word loss can mean presumed loss. And if we have, if we're bound by that rationale, how can we say that the $500 rule is inconsistent or unreasonable application of the word loss?
Well, Your Honor, I guess my response would be that I just don't see how you can read Yellow as addressing whether the use of the term loss in the guideline is in conflict with the commentary. I think it's just basically what Your Honor just described states what the commentary says. It's a presumed, you know, the commentary describes a presumed loss. It doesn't really address the conflict at all.
So going to the merits of that, is a presumed loss inconsistent with the word loss?
With the ordinary, any ordinary definition of that term. I mean, the Ricciardi case does discuss that extensively, but beyond that, I mean, when you think of loss, I mean, it would usually be something based on the fact that the defendant has actually taken, for example, in the credit card case, that the defendant charged to the card of the victim, or, you know, if the actual taking didn't succeed, I suppose whatever amount the defendant tried to take and didn't succeed. But I cannot think of a situation where the term loss would be deemed a presumed amount regardless of what the actual facts are. So I don't think there's any way to deem what the guideline has done, I'm sorry, the commentary has done to be a reasonable interpretation.
So do you think loss cannot mean either a foreseeable loss or an intended loss? It has to mean an actual loss?
Well, no, I think a loss can be an intended loss. In fact, this court has said that many times in interpreting the 2B1.1, that loss is actual, the greater of actual or the intended loss. In fact, I think that's also in the commentary to the guideline.
What about a reasonably foreseeable loss?
Well, I think that's still tied to the facts of the case, because reasonable foreseeability looks at facts of the case. It's not an amount taken in a vacuum. I think that where this is completely different is that it just says, regardless of what the facts are, it's $500. And I think this is in stark contrast to the facts here, because this scheme operated precisely based on the fact they're going to charge very small amounts to avoid detection. And if there's any problem, they're going to reverse the charge so they're not detected.
So it sounds like you're equating actual loss to intended loss, because you're talking about what actually was done. How would you calculate the intended loss in a case like this if you don't think $500 is the appropriate number?
Well, Your Honor, I think actually the intended loss here was calculated. The PSR calculated the actual loss at about $1.5 million and the intended loss at about $3.5 million. So, you know, we have those two numbers in this case.
No, I understand that, but I'm asking you, you're saying actual and intended loss are different losses, and that right. You don't have a problem with intended loss. You just have a problem with how it's calculated here. Now, I'm asking you is how would you calculate it for a case like this?
Well, Your Honor, can I quibble with something just to make sure that my argument is understood
okay.
properly? I'm challenging the presumed loss. And my point is that presumed loss and intended loss are two different things, because intended loss is still based on the facts of the case, whereas a presumed loss, you take a set amount that apparently the commission here picked and apply it regardless or what the defendant's intent was.
So what you're saying then is intended loss and actual loss are equal if you take them from the facts of the case. Well, then I'm asking, how would you calculate the intended loss in a case like this?
Well, in this, you know, the intended loss in a case like this, you would look at what the defendant's intent was in running the scheme. So if you take evidence that the defendants had looked to make charges as small as possible.
So you're back to actual loss then?
Well, no, I would disagree with Your Honor. I'm not saying that they're the same in this case. In fact, probation is not saying that it's the same number. I mean, they've picked two very different numbers. One significantly greater than the other. So I don't think.
Probation uses the intended loss based on the $500 multiplier.
No, Your Honor, I guess I disagree, because the probation's number couldn't have possibly been based on the $500 per card, because that results in $60 million. $3 million, you know, if divided, it's a much different number. So, no, I would respectfully disagree with that.
Can there are a lot of questions here, and I want to ask you before your time is up about the authentication features enhancement.
Of course, sir.
This is not an issue you raise in the briefs, but it's important, obviously, to get it right. And let me ask the question, because here's what it is. I don't understand who the issuing authority here was. The briefs seem to operate on the presumption that the authentication feature, the sequence of numbers, was issued by perhaps a bank or American Express. But an issuing authority has to be a government entity in most circumstances. So I'll ask the government to address that when they come up. This wasn't briefed, but I'm not sure that this was correctly imposed in light of that, and I want to know what your answer is.
Well, I understand the definition to be that the issuing authority either has to be a government entity, and I'm not sure whether it could be a bank. Again, I apologize if my answer isn't crisp, because this is...
Okay, if you're not prepared to address it, that's fine. It was a question.
No, but I want to try to be helpful. I want to try to see if I can answer this. I think the definition in the guideline does focus on the fact that the authenticating feature has to be on a document, and it has to be used by an issuing authority. So I suppose those two facts would suggest that the issuing authority would have to be a government authority. And I agree that it's not an issue that we focused on in our argument. I think this enhancement is problematic for other reasons, but I do agree that for those two reasons, it may be problematic as well. And I don't know, did I answer your question, Aaron?
I think you did. Let me ask you here, other than that issue, what arguments do you have that this authentication feature was incorrectly imposed?
Well, I think that the definition requires the authenticating feature to be used by the issuing authority to distinguish between a counterfeit card and a falsified card. And again, I'm using the term card on the assumption that the word document refers to a card, which I'm not sure that it does, given what we've discussed a few moments ago.
Does there need to be some physical document in all
this? Well, the definition clearly says that it does. It says if the document is counterfeit, altered, or otherwise falsified. And a factual point, in this case, there is no evidence that a physical card was actually used.
Right. That's the question I had. What's the document here? What was the government's theory of what the document was?
I don't think they've identified what the at least in the district court, I don't think they've identified what that theory is. Mr. Morris's theory on appeal was that the credit card numbers were used in opening fake businesses, if I understand his argument correctly. Mr. Morris can correct me if I'm wrong. And I don't think that's accurate. If I'm reading his argument right, I don't think that's accurate, because the only way the card numbers were used, once the fake businesses and the students' names were set up, then you take the stolen numbers and you charge the stolen credit card numbers to those businesses, and you siphon the funds into the merchant accounts. But I don't think there's any evidence that a physical card was ever used.
Right, but the statute that's referenced, 128D1, references a document making implement or means of identification. Then it goes on to say, to determine if the document is counterfeit, altered, or otherwise falsified.
Right. Correct.
A means of identification is elsewhere defined, and it includes things that are not physical documents, like biometric data or names or other things. And so isn't the word "the document" really meaning a document in the sense of a record? It doesn't need to be a physical document.
Right. I'm not sure that I agree with that, Your Honor. I think when the guideline plainly says document, and it hasn't, I don't think there's any evidence of the commission intending anything else. I think we have to go with the definition. And I think, if the if the commission wanted to use the word record, I think that we would have used it. I mean, it's a straightforward enough word.
Well, we've taken almost to the end of your time, and we'll give you time for rebuttal, but let me just ask my colleagues if they want to ask any more questions before we hear from the government.
I could wait till rebuttal.
Okay, we'll put 2 minutes on for rebuttal when you come back.
And, thank you, Your
Honor. We thank you. Mr. Morris, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Matt Morris on behalf of the United States. I'll turn first to this 500 per card question. I think that took up most of the Court's concern in the opening argument. The law is well established, both it's clear in the guidelines and it's clear the law of this circuit that the guidelines mean what they say, the guidelines say what they mean. And Application Note 3F sets a floor, a presumptive loss below which the Court can't go. That's been the law in this circuit for decades, from Yellow and on. It's been relied upon by this Court in co-defendant Melkonian's case and the Cruz case. It's routinely relied upon by the district courts in this circuit as establishing how to calculate this initial guideline cut in cases of false IDs. And
Counsel, that's you would agree, though, Yellow didn't address this precise question of whether or not the presumed loss is consistent with the word loss.
I think that's right. It didn't address it in the sense of this Riccardi argument is a new method of attacking the validity of the $500 per card in the guidelines. But that's exactly what this Court is. This is the type of case that this Court's Miller v. Gammey jurisdiction or jurisprudence says that we shouldn't allow this kind of attack here. So to clarify, you know, what this Court says is that once this Court has established a rule, and that rule here is that the presumptive loss in Application Note 3F sets this floor, and that it's a valid presumption.
Well, Yellow only said that it applied to credit cards, or credit card numbers, I forget which one, but it didn't say that it was consistent with the word loss, so it seems like you're extrapolating from that.
I think I'm trying to make is that what this Court has said in Miller v. Gammey is that when the rule is established, that it isn't that we come up with a new theory every year and come back and try to get a three-judge panel to go out on a different road and create a new rule. If we're going to overturn a well-established rule, that we do it through an en banc process, unless there's intervening higher authority that's clearly irreconcilable with the prior rule.
But if there's a new argument attacking a statute or constitutionality of something, we have to go en banc before we could reach a new argument?
If the effect would be to overturn existing precedent, yes. And so that was really the issue in Miller v. Gammey. So Miller v. Gammey itself was an en banc decision where this Court had to flesh out the question of what's the right thing for a three-judge panel to do and which things are reserved only to an en banc hearing by the Court. So yes, that's what this Court's precedent says, is that simply coming up with a new theory about why we should strike down well-established law, that's not something that a three-judge panel ought to do, unless compelled to do so by intervening higher authority that's clearly irreconcilable. Riccardi is neither higher authority, because the Sixth Circuit is not a higher authority than this Court, nor is Riccardi clearly irreconcilable. I do think that there's some question as to whether, I guess the argument now, raised only in the reply brief, is that Kaiser is somehow clearly irreconcilable with Yellow and with all the cases that have relied on Yellow. And I think that really asks too much of Kaiser. I think it's important to recognize in this context that the Sixth Circuit in Riccardi at page 484 says nobody in our circuit has challenged the applicability of the 500 per card loss before. So they weren't in the place where this Court is, which is that somebody has previously challenged it and it's been held to be applicable. So they were really writing on a clean slate, which this Court isn't. And the other, even if the Court were to get to this question of whether Kaiser mandates this decision, it really doesn't. So, you know, Kaiser talks about an agency, to use the Sixth Circuit's description, willy-nilly changing a definition. And that's not what happened with this particular application note. As we pointed out, and as the King case from the Seventh Circuit that we cite in the briefs talks about, this change was both mandated by Congress and then subject to notice and comment rulemaking and then sent back to Congress for their thumbs up or thumbs down. So that's very different than the type of situation that caused the Supreme Court concern in Kaiser, where an agency simply said, today we've decided without notice and comment rulemaking, we've decided to interpret this word differently.
Well, counsel, by them putting it in the commentary, tomorrow they could change the rule, right? The commission could change the rule and it wouldn't be subject to any congressional oversight.
That is something which the Sixth Circuit sort of forecasts as being a problem. But if the court is speculating that there might be a problem someday in the future, then the right case to worry about that would be the case in the future where that happened. So what happened with this case was...
You're suggesting because the commentary was presented to Congress here, it becomes the law or the authoritative definition? Because that seems to suggest that Stinson no longer applies.
I don't think it calls into question Stinson. Stinson actually was talking about the fact that really a question of applying plain error review and whether or not we can do our deference with plain error review. The facts here, what happened in this case was that Congress in the Identity Theft and Assurance Act, I think it was the ITADA, directed the commission review and amend both the guidelines and your policy statements to reflect the changes of how these crimes have happened. They specifically asked the commission assess whether harm to victims' reputation should be considered, whether inconvenience to the victims should be part of something that drives this guideline, and specifically said whether question the adequacy of the value of a loss to an individual as being the way to drive these guidelines. So the commission did research and analyzed data. And then they subjected this to notice and comment rulemaking, which makes it different from Kaiser, and then sent it back to Congress and say, you've ordered us to do this. We've done it. Here's what we think. Are we off base? And Congress didn't reel them back in. So it's a really different situation than was dealt with by Kaiser. And the court ought to give at least some deference.
Does that make sense, though? Because since it was put in the commentary, Congress might not have focused on it. Right, it didn't become binding. The binding definition of a loss is for the commentary. This might be a formalist problem, right? It's that the process was fine as long if they put it into the actual guideline, then it would be untouchable. But since they put it in the commentary, it just seems that it is subject to review.
Of course, it's subject to review, Your Honor. But I think what's important, two things that jump out at me. First is there was already a presumptive loss of $100 per card prior to this amendment. So this existed, and that was the presumptive loss that Congress directed the commission to ask, is that the right number? The other reason why I think I wouldn't agree with the court's, the premise of the court's question is that the act specifically asked the commission to review the policy statements and make changes if needed. So I don't think it's fair to say that if Congress directed the commission, look at the policy statements, and if that policy statement already contains a presumptive loss, that means that Congress then, when they get back the result of what they asked for, somehow didn't pay attention to the very thing that they ordered the commission to evaluate, which was the policy statements.
Just one quick follow-up. Where did the $500 come from then?
According to the Sentencing Commission's amendment, they said it was research and data. And so they went back and looked at this question of what are these harms that aren't currently captured? And they said the ones that Congress specifically told them to think about was harm to reputation, inconvenience, and the adequacy of the value of loss to an individual. So they didn't spell out exactly what that research and data, and they didn't give all of the background, but they then subjected this to the notice and commentary, and even after notice and comment, they implemented it after sending it to Congress. But they didn't spell out, for example, we have found that the average, these sort of ancillary losses are on average not $150, but are $450. They didn't go to that level of detail.
Thanks, sir.
On the we'll get to the authentication issue in a second, but first I did want to cover the so-called illegal sentence, and obviously we appreciate the government raising that issue. But in light of that, doesn't the sentence need to be vacated for that reason alone to let the district court decide what to do here?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. Because this is up on plain error review, we're really looking at this Buckland and Kent's are the governing cases, and those cases say that this doesn't satisfy the third prong, let alone the fourth prong of plain error review. And the reason that those cases go there is because The court's question of shouldn't the court decide what to do, the guidelines tell the court exactly what it has to do, which is you have to run the highest stat max to its max, and then you have to stack the next crime onto it until you get to the point where you've got the sentence you want. So if this had been raised in front of the district court, if we had caught it, or if the defense had caught it, or if the court had caught it itself, or probation, if anybody had noticed what was going on, then the guidelines section 5G1.2 sub D says is that the court has to still impose the same 27-year sentence. It just has to find a way to manipulate the numbers on these counts to run them concurrent to the point that you still come to 27 years. So the end result would be the Bureau of Prisons calculation for the day that Mr. Kirilluk leaves prison would be no changed, because the sentence would have to be the same and the guidelines mandate that. And that's really, I think, what drove this court's decisions in Buckland and Kent's to say that this is not the kind of error. We agree that it is an error, and it was an obvious error. It should have been caught. But Buckland and Kent say it doesn't affect substantial rights.
Those are pre-Booker cases, right? So, I mean, the district court here, you know, it imposed the sentence of 264 months. It then stacked the others on top of that. I mean, what basis is there to say that if the district court knew that, in fact, the statutory maximum was 240 on the fraud, it wouldn't have just done 240 as a starting point and then stacked, and he would have a sentence that's 2 years less than what he has now?
Because that would have been error by the district court, Your Honor. So it's post-Booker, it's very clear how sentencing court is supposed to do this. You start with the guidelines, calculate the guidelines, and then you close that book, and then you say, I'm going to look now at the 3553 factors, and the 3553 factors tell me that this is the right sentence, and what this court said was 27 years. So it actually would have been error if the court had then said, oh, wait a second, now I'm going back and I'm realizing that one of these has a 20-year stat max. I'm now changing my 3553 analysis for some reason. That would be wrong. So it is mandated under Cardi and mandated by the guidelines that that has to be structured in this way. It's certainly the case post-Booker that he's allowed to set whatever sentence he thinks is right consistent with 3553, but that's what he did when he picked a 27-year sentence. And once he picked that, he had to structure the consecutive sentences.
Right, but I mean, this is a chicken and the egg problem, right? I mean, where did he pick that from? Did he begin with the understanding that the statutory maximum was 264 and build off of that to get to 27? I mean, you say that he started with 27 and he needed to then essentially create a sentence that worked there, but I'm not sure we know that.
I think we do know that because that's what the law says he had to do, right? So Cardi says you calculate the guidelines, and then with them as a starting point, you do the 3553 to find the sentence you think is appropriate. So he had to.
Okay, let me ask, let's talk about the authentication issue, and can you address this issue of the issuing authority? Who is the issuing authority here?
I don't know, Your Honor. I think we'd have to say that because the theory was that these were the identities or the signatures of the people whose identities were taken over, but we weren't talking about cloning of a card, then the issuing authority, to the extent it's applicable, would have to be that person.
But I mean, the issuing authority is the one that issues the identification document or the means of identification. And so if it were a social security number or something like that, then the government has issued that, but the government didn't issue Amex numbers. And so I'm not sure this was correct. And I know it wasn't raised by anybody and no one's briefed it, but it doesn't seem that it's right.
I appreciate the court's perspective. I do think that there is that view would have to be in tension, at least, if not contradicting Sardariani, because that is kind of the argument raised in Sardariani, and that was the notary seal case.
Yeah, but the notary seal is a little different, don't you think?
It is a little bit different, I agree. But one of the arguments made there was that this notary seal wasn't put on some piece of plastic issued by the government, and therefore you shouldn't call this an authentication feature, and this court said that it was. And so there's a slightly... It's hard to reconcile if the rule is it has to be some government piece of plastic and then something else that's associated with this government piece of plastic. It's hard to reconcile how Sardariani correctly applied it for the notary seal.
What about the issue of the document? Does there need to be a document, like a physical document or record?
I don't think that's the case because it does, as the court pointed out, that it says means of identification earlier in that same section. So it's talking about, and this section is also phrased relatively expansively. So it talks about, you know, it goes through a list of things like holograms and so forth. But then it says any sequence of numbers or letter or other feature, which alone or in combination with another feature, gives this assurance that what I'm looking at is legitimate. And so I think it...
But it goes on to say to determine if the document is counterfeit, altered, or otherwise falsified.
It does, Your Honor. It does. And that might be a good clue for me to focus in on our harmlessness argument for this one.
So just so I know, understand, does the government have a theory what the document is? Or are you just saying that you don't need to prove it?
I think it would have to be the account records. If we're saying that you have slipped yourself in and assumed the identity of these J-1 visa holders, for example, who created these accounts, it would have to be the account creation documents. By that theory, it's like if I walk into a bank and say, my name is Joe Smith, I'd like all the money in the Joe Smith account, they're going to say, can I see some ID? So the means of identification is I'm Joe Smith, and I'm the person whose account this is, and the authentication feature is look at this ID card that I'm giving you that says I'm Joe Smith.
Right.
So the document is the account, whether that's a physical thing or something that's essentially computerized or intangible.
I think if it's required that there be a document, then that would have to be what it is. It's these documents that constitute the account, the identity that they've taken over.
You want to go to harmless error?
Yeah, if I've got some time here, I know I'm really short, but the short line is that, you know, Munoz-Camarena says, and I think it's pretty clear that we in the district court tried to do what this court has said in Munoz-Camarena, which is if there's some question about a two-level adjustment, calculate the guidelines both ways and then say, would you still give the same sentence in this court at the request of the government said that? And that's why under Munoz-Camarena and Leisure, the prior case, that's why it's harmless as to either of the two-level enhancements. I see that I'm definitely
over time. Your time is up.
I
want to make sure that my colleagues don't have anything else to ask of you. Okay. Well, let's put 3 minutes on from Mr. Vorobyev, who we've been going a little longer this morning, but important issues. So please go ahead.
So, Your Honor, it took me a second to unmute. So I actually wanted to pick up with the harmlessness error argument first, because this is where Mr. Morris left off. My read of Munoz-Camarena is actually quite different from him. I think it stands for the proposition that in most cases, when the judge merely says, well, I would have imposed the same sentence regardless, that's not enough to avoid the remand. In fact, in Munoz-Camarena, the judge did one better and basically said, even if the Ninth Circuit reverses me, I'm going to still impose the same sentence, which we don't have here. And what I think we have in this case, at least it's possible that the judge imposed a sentence as a product of 264 on the fraud, 24 on the ID theft, and 36 on failure to appear. So it's not 27 reason backwards. It's actually a package that ends up with 324, and you can look at probation's recommended sentence as an example of that, because they have 300 based on 240 plus 36 plus 24. So I think there is at least a reasonable chance that the sentence here is actually a product of a sentencing package, a component of which is illegal. And I know it's some plain error, but all we need in order to satisfy that requirement is to show reasonable possibility that their error might have affected 324, and I think that's in here. And I will also add that there is at least, at minimum, a failure to explain how you get, why there is an imposition of 36 months and they escape, even though there is, that crime is accounted in the guidelines by a five-level increase. There was a defense argument there should be something lower because of that, and there is no explanation as to why the court still went with that number. So I think you can take that as an additional factor as to why this really should go back. Now, unless the court has an objection, I want to quickly jump on back to the $500 per card rule argument. I disagree with Mr. Morris that Yellow set a law on this issue. I would direct this court's attention to a recent Crump case from the circuit, where the court faced a similar problem. There is an argument there is a conflict between the commentary and the guideline. And the court said, well, we're writing on a blank slate, we would agree. But because there is a specific prior case addressing that conflict, and the court said that there's no conflict, so then we're bound and we have to go the Miller versus Gummy route. We don't have that here. Yellow did not address.
What case did you cite for that?
United States versus Crum. I would be happy to 28J this to the court as soon as we're done to give you the precise site. But I think it gives you an example. The court went and basically said you have to go back in that situation because there was a prior case specifically addressing that issue. We don't have that here.
I think we have your argument, Mr. Rubio, but I want to make sure that my colleagues don't have any additional questions for you.
Just one last question. Could you make the argument to the district court that the $500 per card rule is discretionary and he doesn't have to impose it in this case?
Well, given the present present authority, I probably not. Because the rule seems mandatory on its face. So I think the only way to get there is to validate it. So if it's a question gearing at whether or not the Ricardi argument could have been made earlier, I don't think it could have been. Because there's no, you know, we had the KISOR come out, but I, at the district court level, the district court is not going to accept that. I think this court can, but not at the district court level.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both counsel for the briefing and argument, and this case is submitted.
Thank you, Aaron.